who normally heads up the gold team, but is the EVA specialist and took over the white team today. And we have our Sterling Capcom, Stu Russa, who appears to be on at all hours. I think anytime you tune in, you'll hear Stu. And he plans on getting back very early in the morning, so let's get started with a summary of this shift from Jerry.
Okay, we came on about a little early this morning, about 5 o'clock. As you're aware, we had worked most of the night on revising the flight plan to show the reduced EVA activity that we had initially planned for today. That effort took most of the night, and we also went through a quite lengthy checklist revision to make sure we had the new situation covered. About the time we picked up, we had just started to update the crew on both what we planned to do with the flight plan and also the checklist changes. That took us several sites, quite lengthy, but we did get him updated. It became apparent while we were updating him that we didn't really need to power up the platform or computer for today's activities, since we didn't, the attitude constraints weren't quite as stringent as we wanted before. So we made the decision there to go, you probably heard, I guess, that we made the decision to go with our backup stabilization control system control in the CSM with essentially the same thruster configuration that we would have had with the primary guidance system. What this did for us, it bought us a little time in the timeline. It meant that Dave Scott didn't have to align the platform and get the computer ready for holding attitude during the EVA. We did essentially the same thing this morning that we did yesterday morning. That is, as we got started, we got behind, and I'll let maybe Stu can fill us in a little more of what these suits and hoses are like, but Jim's commented, I guess you also heard on the air to ground, that seems to be taking a little longer than we had planned in getting suited up and getting the hoses routed around the spacecraft in a proper manner and getting ready to transfer. So we started out a little bit behind again this morning, and as a result, we ended up scrubbing some comm checks that we had tried to pick up from yesterday's flight plan and today's flight plan. We cut those out as a first-order priority, and as it ended up, that's all we had to scrub from the flight plan was just the comm checks. The crew also reported that they hadn't had time to chlorinate the water in the CSM, and they were reportedly doing that as about the time we left the control center, they were chlorinating water in the CSM. Pretty normal from there on down. We did have one indication of a slightly or low supercritical helium pressure in the dip stage that we quizzed the crew on eventually and got a readout from. We don't feel this is a problem. It is somewhat low, but the dips is still in good shape for tomorrow. That's the descent propulsion system. We verified that readout on board and subsequently chase that thing to its conclusion, and I haven't gotten all the details on it because it was being done while we were doing the EVA, but I understand that it is in a go situation. Let me see here. That's about all I've got down to the time that we started to depress the cabins, and I think most of you heard the air to ground. You heard the same air to ground I did. So I won't go into what the crew was saying. We did have a tremendous TV pass, I thought. Some of the best TV pictures that we've seen to date. And I think probably the most significant thing that we got out of today, we of course found out that the crew performed very well, but of course it was our first chance to see the ECS system on both spacecraft as dynamic as they were today, and they both performed beautifully. The procedures, as the crew reported, and as we can certainly verify on the ground, the procedures that they used seemed to work beautifully. They had no problem getting in and out of the spacecraft and handling the ECS system, getting the spacecraft depressurized and repressurized. So all in all, it sounded pretty good. Now, in fact, it sounded great. I'm not sure you've got this. Let me see if I can find it. For you, those that are interested, this control mode that we ended up using in the CSM only required about 2 pounds of fuel for the entire EVA, which was significantly less than we had planned. Actually, I guess he said to get into attitude, it took a little more, but we used very little propellant out of the CSM today, and it puts us in real good shape for the rendezvous tomorrow, RCS-wise. So we're in real good shape there. Let me see what else I got. We briefed them on a new cryo plan for tonight, and instead of letting the pressure go low and build up over the night, we're going to build up the pressure in the hydrogen tanks to around 270 psi and then let it slowly come down over the night, and we feel that we can make the nighttime without having a heater cycle, which is where he gets this master caution and warning I'm sure you've been briefed on. So we're at that point in the H2 tanks where we now are crossing over from being able to run it down low and let it build up or versus running it high and letting it decay. So we're right in that hazy area right now. We feel we can make it tonight by doing this. Rusty's heart rates during the EVA ran from a low of 61 to a high of 88. That's what I was trying to find for you. As we were leaving, Jim McDivitt had already transferred back to the CSM, and Rusty was in the final stages of closing out the limb. He had completed the sublimator dryout, had secured that system, and was, I'm sure, and maybe even now, in the process of getting back into the CSM, securing for the night. I think that's about it.
Hey, why don't we go to questions, Bill?
Maybe somebody can give us a sequence of events and how the full or the expanded EVA got back into the program. At 7:30 this morning, they were saying that there wasn't going to be anything more than a hatch opening. There wasn't much said during the air to ground. Now, can you explain this to us?
Yes. In fact, I intended to on my first run through. We fully had planned and had updated the flight plan to the crew based on not going any further than opening the hatch. The first time that we had the impression that Rusty and Jim felt they could go a little further was...
Would you speak a little louder?
Okay, sorry. And let me look here. I can tell you exactly what the time was. This was at Mercury at 70. I don't have it, Bill, in... clock time, but in ground elapsed time, it's around 71:30. CDR reported they wanted to go ahead and hook up the OPS to the LMP.
What's the OPS?
That's the oxygen purge system, which is the backup system that rides on top of the PLIS. We had planned in the flight plan we generated last night, not to hook that system up. And at that time, it at least became apparent to me that maybe he was thinking about doing something a little more than what we had planned, but we didn't ask him about it. These guys were very busy during this time. And we chose...
40 seconds down the
list. Yeah. And he wasn't telling us anyway. He was talking back and forth to Rusty. So chose not to say anything else about it and just wait to see. The next inkling I had when we got up over the States at around 71:50, I heard him say something about get the tether or need to get the tether out. And at that time, it's about the time that Jim came to us and said that he felt that they could go ahead and do one day pass on the porch. This was just about the same time frame. So that's the way that sequence of events went, and we were willing to go with Rusty and Jim's judgment on that. I can't tell you what they were thinking. It was obvious that they felt pretty good and felt that they could do it. So,
well, how much consultation was there on the ground? It looked from reading the air to ground that there was just minimal consultation. You went back and said, "Okay, go ahead."
That's right.
5 seconds.
Very little.
Go ahead, Ray.
Even though you didn't transfer between the two spaceships, would you say that the expanded EVA gave you most of what you had hoped to get out of EVA?
Yes, I do. We got...
I don't know if you heard the air ground on that or not, but Jim was summing up here in the quiet period while they're waiting for the limb water boiler to dry out, and he commented on that he felt that the procedures that they had worked out, they felt they had proven them, and they were real happy with them, and felt that they should stand, and they're ready to go with them.
Were there, just for the record, any private conversations about this EVA?
Negative.
Any private conversations about anything?
Negative.
It did seem that you were caught by surprise by the EVA, but as the events developed, you gained more confidence and gave them a blank check to go as far as they wanted. Had they requested to go total EVA to the CM, would you have approved?
I think not. I'll be as honest with you as I can there. When he talked about going through the dark pass, I guess we probably talked about it on the ground more than that, our intention today was to try to get them to sleep a little bit early. Tomorrow we wanted to have them in the best shape we possibly could for the rendezvous. And the only way we could save time, we had looked at the flight plan in a lot of detail, the only way we could save time was to get back in at the end of that first daylight pass. So my opinion is no. I think we went about as far as we would have gone today.
Jerry, you might say that as far as the EVT, there was nobody had any doubts of that. The only reason why that it would have been turned down was strictly the time. They want more time to get ready for the rendezvous in the morning.
Was there any conversation in which Rusty insisted on going EVA?
Negative. You heard all the air to ground.
Go ahead, Roy.
Okay. Jerry, can we look at tomorrow now? Are you planning to stay by the flight plan in regard to times and events, or do you see any deviation in sight at this time?
Let me answer it in general. Say, Roy, about the only thing that's different is we're going to be getting him up about an hour earlier than is in the flight plan. But as far as the rendezvous sequence of events itself, it will be on time.
Why are you going to get him up early?
Give him a little more time to get into the limb.
You've experienced the fact that now you need a little spread time at the early part of the day.
That's
as
right.
I did.
Go ahead, Steve.
Jim also commented on this, and it's what we're worrying about when they were delayed yesterday. He elaborated a little bit today. It's essentially you've got three people that you've got to get ready, and they've got to get a suit on and hooked up to the hoses and probably do a platform align and so forth. And the only place to work is in the LEB, and it's a one-man job. So the time that we've been allowing for the three to get all geared up and get ready, they just can't do it. And they've commented that once they're geared up and suited and ready to go, the tunnel clearing and everything goes right on schedule, and they can pretty well stay up. And so that operation is going real smooth. It's just three people in a small place trying to get in the suits, and as you've probably heard, the hoses are stiff and they're hard to work with, and that's why they need the extra time.
What is the present status of the sequence cameras?
You want to answer that? They're go. But.
Yeah, we covered that. Also, Dave said that he blew a fuse on his, that he's got a new fuse in it, and it's working good. We were thinking of swapping the one out of the limb to make sure we got the undocking photos, and Dave said it was working good. I don't know, but what may not still do that if they would agree. But as right now, all the cameras are good.
Will this additional time in suiting up affect any portions of the lunar mission that you could see now? Timeline.
Well, I'm not real familiar with the lunar timeline yet, but I would think that it certainly has taught us something about this operation now the suiting, of course, we have done before, but we've never done the limb tunnel hardware and all that. I would certainly think that the data we get out of this mission on time and that sort of thing will be factored into the lunar timeline, yes.
I think when Jim comes back, he'll probably help us out a lot on that. I'm sure their comments will do a lot to the training on downstream when you get ready to get on that next mission.
Two questions. What are the present orbital parameters, and Is Swigert eating regularly now or taking any medicine?
The present orbital parameters, after that, I can get them exactly. We're approximately 128 by 126, somewhere in that order. And I can get them for you exactly after this thing. As far as, let's see, your second question was,
is Swigert eating regularly and is he taking any medicine?
As far as we know, as far as I know anyway, and I think Stu's probably in the same boat, I don't think he's taking any medication. He hasn't reported any. He may have. As far as eating, we were going to try to get some kind of idea of that this morning, but with them running behind, we never did quiz him on it, and I can't tell you there. I did see him, I think, drinking something there on TV, but I really just don't know whether he's eating anything or not.
The doctors don't know of any medication he's taking either. John, I talked to them just a little while ago.
Two questions. One, was he on the backpack the full time, not on the umbilical?
That's right.
And the other, I can't tell from the transcripts. It says when they closed the hatch, but I'm trying to figure out the amount of time he was outside the spaceship. Was the hatch closing basically the same? That would be about 42 minutes if it was time
it's
to egress.
Very close to that. It might have been a little later.
I think the limb was depressurized a little over an hour, wasn't it? An hour and 6 minutes or something like that?
Something like that. And I caught him at Canary here, but I didn't write the time down that they were back up to 3.5. But we can get those for you. It's very nearly on what the flight plan had.
He spent a lot of time after he got in before he closed the hatch.
No.
Seconds.
Minutes, I would think.
Is the delay in chlorinating the water in the CSM the reason that Scott and McDivitt wanted Schweikart to use the limb water for their food?
Negative. They want to drink the limb water because it doesn't have gas in it. And, in fact, they made the comment that they're mixing up tonight's meal using the limb water, and they're all planning on a big feed tonight. And while Rusty's letting the water boiler dry out, he's mixing up the food over there. So this was the reason for the limb water.
Did anybody happen to note during that next to the last scene in the TV what station you were over, the one that showed the command module and the Earth background? Was that Texas or Mila?
Yeah, they were over the Mila station.
Mila.
Yeah.
Okay. And secondly, why, as you noted, Jerry, we've had suiting up before. Why have we not run into this problem of the one-hour period? Is it that it's never been condensed into such a brief period of time?
Well, yes, and we just never have done this operation, Art, where everybody has to get down in the LEB kind of at the same time to get up, you know, through the tunnel. That's what it is. It's routing hoses and all that sort of thing. And of course, in 7 and 8, when we suited, we weren't doing anything with any kind of tunnel operation or hardware. So that's what it is primarily, I feel. And of course, Jim's comments mean a lot here.
Nobody suited up to such a strict timeline, I don't think, before. You know, where, you know, X hours you got to be suited and rocket on ready, and that's probably.
Could you give us the normal heart rate for Schweikart, please, first of all? And secondly, could you give us any idea what the filmed pictures might show that were taken today? I got the impression from air to ground that Scott's camera was not working while Schweikart was outside.
I don't know what... You're talking about Rusty's normal heart rate on the ground? Gosh, I don't know.
It's in the low 60s, I think, around 60 or high 50s even. But I don't know if the precise, but it runs 58, 59, 60, around in there.
Now, Stu might have gotten another answer than I have. I understood that Dave had trouble with his camera very near the end of the EVA, and I don't think he was having trouble for the major part of the time that Rusty was out on the porch.
I can't remember the calls that well. It seemed to me like maybe somebody here probably remembers it better, but I think it was when Rusty was trying the handrails, if I remember right, that Dave was going to try to get some pictures of him then, and he reported the camera trouble. Now, this was toward the end of the EVA, and so we should have some good pictures of Rusty on the porch. Also, Jim took pictures from inside, and then, of course, as you well know, passed the camera out to Rusty, and he stood on the outside and took pictures of both the vehicles and so forth. So that's first cut at what the pictures might be.
Tom O'Toole over here.
Can you tell us exactly what Rusty did when he was outside and how far he went? And could you evaluate at this time the performance of the suits and the backpack, et cetera? Obviously, they worked. But
I can't tell you exactly what he did. I can tell you that he went out on the porch and got in the slippers, and he did. He accepted some cameras, et cetera, from Jim and took some pictures. And he was doing something with the handrails. Exactly what, I can't tell you because I didn't see it. He was doing something on the handrails, probably, I imagine, standing in the porch area and reaching out to the first few handrails and grabbing hold of them, that sort of thing. Your second question was?
I got the performance of the backpack
suit. Okay, I'll let Stu finish. The plis and the suits and all, as I tried to say earlier, it worked beautifully, just absolutely beautiful. He stayed in the minimum diverter valve setting, and I think you heard him comment on that, which means that he was asking the plis to provide cooling in a minimum setting and had no problem at all.
Did he find it more or less comfortable than he expected?
He didn't comment on it. I'm sure he found it to be very much what he expected. You might.
No, that's about it. He said his hands were slightly warm, which happens also in the environmental chambers. That's nothing new. And he said slightly warm, but comfortable. The cooling was most adequate. And I got, here again, we'll have to wait till we see the films or a little better debriefing, but I got the impression that Rusty probably was on the handrail only, not standing on the porch.
I didn't mean to imply that he was still in the slippers. He was in the porch area, though, holding
but on the I suspect he moved up and down the first rail there, and how far he went, I don't know either. But wait and see that.
Right next to you.
Rusty's comments seem to indicate to me that the effort required to maneuver while on those handrails was considerably less than what was expected. I know he was working out with weights, trying to stay in shape. Is that the way NASA is looking at that now?
That's what he said.
Overtraining?
As far as weight training?
Yeah, were you too concerned about it? Is it a lot easier than we all thought?
Well, I don't think you can underestimate EVA. I think it's pretty tough, and if you got time to lift a lot of weights, I sure would before I went EVA. But I got the impression that that he did find himself on the handrails. He could control his body position real well, and yes, he seemed most satisfied that there would be no problems in making EVT. He made a point of this, and Jim did also in his summary.
If I may, I have a second question about tomorrow's activities. We've heard about LEM rescue possibility by Scott. Is there an outside figure in distance that you think of as being, if something went wrong, as being the farthest distance the LEM could be away and have the CSM still affect a rescue?
Well, no. We're set up such that we control that distance, even in the CSM rescue case. And even in the CSM rescue case, he would initiate a rescue at no greater distance than we plan to go out on the normal one. In other words, I don't know if you're familiar with the profile. If you miss the CSI burn with the limb, you're going to make it with the CSM. So your distance is essentially the same. And now you're on a return trajectory, or starting toward a return trajectory. So we control that distance no matter whether it's a normal case or a rescue.
Do you have any indication of how many of the thermal samples they retrieved?
I think Rusty probably got all of them off the limb, and I think that Dave probably got the one that's close to the hatch. I heard him say something about it, but it was buried in the air to ground a little bit in conversation. And Steve, what do you think? Do you think he got that sample? We haven't quit.
I think so, yeah.
I think he did.
I think he did.
One out of how many?
Let's see. Is there three or five on it? I get them.
I'm not sure. I got the impression we got three samples in, but I didn't really take the time to go back and look at the
results. Well,
we'll
quiz
like
him on that and get you.
But
you'll have an answer.
We really didn't talk about it afterwards either.
Jerry, when Dave Scott stood up in the command module hatchway, how far out of the hatch was he?
And what was his position, sitting, standing, or how was he supporting himself, by his hands or how?
I think I'll probably let Stu answer that. He didn't get out of the hatch, though. You've been in more of those.
No, I can't say for sure. Again, it was a little hard to tell from his comments, but I think he was out of the hatch and had at least his head out looking around and this type of thing. He, as far as what he's probably doing is just in relation to the command module, he's probably just in a horizontal position across the couches there. But I really don't know how to answer your question any better than that. Maybe try again.
Do you think he had more than his head out? Do you think he was out there up as far as his waist? And if so, would he have been supporting himself on the edges of the spacecraft or just leaning against the couch or how?
I can't say for sure, but I seriously doubt if he'd be out like his waist out, no.
I think we're going to have to wait till he gets back to find that out.
We may all be proven wrong when he comes back and he's hanging on with one hand on the outside.
How hard a flight plan timeline figure is this 9238 for undocking? This is a broadcaster's question, obviously, because a lot of us are coming on the air right up pretty close to that time. For instance, this morning, they actually opened the hatches some 8 to 10 minutes sooner than we thought. Do they have this latitude at their own discretion tomorrow? How hard a time is 9238, in other words?
When we left the control center, the initial look at the rendezvous plan had been made, and all the times were approximately 3 minutes later than you see them in your plan. Now, that may, as we work on it during the night and get the orbit down closer and closer by tracking longer, you may see that change a little bit. But it's within a few minutes now of where it ought to be. And we do control that undocking time because, as you remember, we do some station keeping there. And we want to do that at a specific time so we can see it over sight. So it's not going to slip too much. It might go one way or the other a little bit, but it'll be close.
Could you explain the difference in the water in the limb and in the command module? And what is this gas you spoke of?
Okay, very simply, in the lunar module, you store water on the ground in a tank, and then you expel it and take it out. In the command module, you take fuel cell water off the hydrogen side of the fuel cell, and as a result, you're going to get some hydrogen in the water. And that's what this gas is. As it heats up, it comes into a gas and comes on out.
Could this in any way make you sick at your stomach?
No. As far as I know, it can, and I'm sure it's not damaging to in the degree that we're taking it for sure. And that's not a problem.
Go ahead, Art.
How good a workout did the PLIS actually get under the circumstances in which there wasn't a complete EVA transfer? How much of a sweat did he work up? Do we have any BTU figures?
I really don't have those figures. I think we probably will before long. The EMU people are going back and, you know, they have a lot of calculations they have to make to get these BTU figures run out completely. And it was on the order, I think, I think I heard a first impression it might have been around 500 BTUs, something on that order. But we'll get a more definitive answer than that in a day or so.
Wait, how?
Do you know what, if anything, fell out of the limb when the hatch was open? And do you have any comment to make about the nut that was between the two panes?
Okay. I don't know what it is. Probably some sort of bag, I think. Maybe a food bag or something went out the door. He commented that there was a washer between the panes. And then he also commented that there was a nut, too. And I think that's when Dave Scott asked him, you're talking about me again or something.
Yeah.
And, I don't have any comment.
I can't answer about the bags coming out either. Could well have been a food bag or some, maybe.
He said a bag full of goodies or something.
Yeah, it seemed like he mentioned that, but he was also talking about some of the Velcro or the snaps that come off of some of his other bags that he carries, the checklists and so forth over there in. I'm sure there was not a checklist or something in it, or he'd been a little more concerned, but he implied it was just some waste bag of some sort, and I suspect it's probably a
little bag floating away.
Yeah.
Did Schweikert breathe off the OPS at all? And if so, is that the first time that that's been done?
Did he what?
Breathe from the OPS, did he?
No. No, that's strictly a backup system.
So that has never been done? That has not been used at all?
Not in flight,
not in flight.
Go ahead, Roy.
I have a question for Stu. A little confusion in our minds as to how the Capcoms are scheduling themselves into the shifts, because we have several names in each position. And the other day, I think you worked about 12 hours instead of the scheduled 8. Do you fellas plan to maintain a regular 8-hour by-the-shift schedule from this point in?
I'd be interested to hear this answer, because I may learn something myself.
We like to be able to say, this is so-and-so talking to so-and-so, and that's where we get confused in the broadcast business.
Well, I guess this started out as being on the support crew for this... for this mission, like we split up, Al Warden was working on the CSM and Jack Lousma on the LIM, and we thought with the complexity of this mission, we needed somebody as directly working with Flight Control Division, and so I started working with Jerry and the troops over there, and mission rules and procedures, so forth and so on. And then it came down time for the Capcom, where I was pretty familiar with it, and it is a pretty complex mission and so forth, so I thought, well, I'd pretty well stick with the first 5 days' activities without any regard to a normal white-gold duty cycle and work on that. And this is the way we simmed it, and this is the way we're going to fly it. After tomorrow, Ron Evans, Al Warden, and I will probably go on an 8-hour basis, but this will probably not rotate with the flight control teams as such. But it'll be on just about an 8-hour cycle, but not necessarily with the ship.
We'll just have to follow the action, in other words.
I guess so, Roy.
Follow-up question to that, though. From an astronaut's point of view, realizing that tomorrow is probably the biggest day of the whole mission, but from an astronaut's point of view, what has been learned so far in this mission that's important?
Oh, gosh, I don't think my view's probably any different than anyone else's in that respect. I think the mission has really been a 100% success so far, and as you say, tomorrow's the really big show. Essentially everything that's been done on this mission is brand new. The dock burns, the stroker test, of course, the big question was the day 3 and the powering up of the LIM, how the systems work. I really don't think that I've got an exclusive view on the mission. I can just say it's going so well, and that's about it.
I guess what I'm driving at there are things like motion sickness, for instance. You're going to have to fly a mission someday.
Have you
learned anything from watching Rusty in this mission? Today he sounded great. Yesterday he sounded terrible. Have you learned anything from perhaps observing what's going on there?
Well, I'm sure we will when Rusty gets back and we have time to talk and debrief. As of now, not really, because I don't know what they really have done, other than as we talked yesterday, that we're going to take things slow and easy, and that's pretty much been... That was the original theme of EVA, you know, go nice and slow and easy, and when you get in a vehicle as big as the command module, lunar module stuck together with an open tunnel, why, you're essentially EVA, so we just keep getting the spacecraft a little bigger, and I'm sure that we will have learned a lot when we can get back and talk with him.
Go ahead. Do you have a hard figure or a good estimate on how long the PLSS was supporting Schweikert?
Let's see. Why don't you go ahead and ask another question? Let me see if I can
follow up.
Put that together.
Really, it's
totally unrelated.
4 hours at 1,500. So many BTUs in that beauty.
No, he's asking
how long was he on the
place?
What's your other question? Go ahead.
The other question is, tomorrow, after undocking, during station keeping, is there a fly around of the CSM around the limb to check leg deployment, et cetera? And if there is, can you tell us what that really involves? Is it, will it really be a 360-degree fly around?
I'll take that. Okay. Yes, after the vehicles, they'll undock, and the limb will go through a maneuver where they'll end up with, of course, you're looking out the front hatches of the front windows of the limb standing up, and you're looking at the nose of the command module in this position. And at this point, the limb will do a 360-degree yaw maneuver at around a degree per second, something like this. And Dave will have his be taking pictures of it and examining it. And then when it finishes, the limb will actually rotate to where the bottom, the bell of the descent engine, is pointed right at the command module, and it will be photographed and inspected at that time. And then they'll come down and 25 minutes after the undocking, they'll do their first separation maneuver. So this will take place within the first 25 minutes after undocking.
Can we call that last maneuver a pitch? Is that what that is? They're like this, and then the limb pitches over?
Well, I guess you might get into the old argument of pilot pitch versus some other kind. There's only one pitch. That's pilot pitch, and that would be a pitch maneuver, yes.
Okay, it looks like, from the best I can estimate, he was on the Pliss something a little over an hour.
Go ahead, Ron.
Just a quick one. We were talking a moment ago about those windows. To date, we've had very little conference about the windows. Are they in good, clear shape as far as you know? Have they held up, in other words, a lot better than they did on 7-8?
They certainly haven't said anything, Roy, that would make us think that anything's changed since yesterday. And at that time, they said they were in good shape for the rendezvous. They had some problem on the left-hand rendezvous window, but that even it was still okay.
Basically, then, that the window problem has been solved by baking the sealant, pretty much. What was done, yeah.
I don't really know either. Well, that was one of the questions we wanted to ask, find out today, and we didn't have time, was had they changed much. But we didn't get this answer, and when they gave it the other day, it didn't sound like the windows were in too bad a shape. And Dave didn't comment at all today when he was trying to photograph anything, so at least whatever window he was working on then, we didn't get any comments.
We'll get more comments on that, Roy, for sure, before this flight's over.
Am I right in my understanding that Scott didn't have an extravehicular visor?
That Scott didn't have any?
Yeah.
No, I don't think he does.
Wouldn't it be a bit hazardous to go out without the EVVA and direct sunlight?
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. Okay. You're talking about an EVVA.
Right.
Yeah, I guess he's got to have one.
Mm-hmm. He had one.
He did have one then.
Yeah.
Right, Matt, next
there.
Can you tell us the reason why communication suddenly improved so markedly today?
Is there any reasons it hasn't improved?
It did. Why it did improve today? It got much clearer. Communication seemed to be much better.
Where it had improved.
Surprises me. We've had some problems today that we didn't quite have a handle on when we left over there. We felt it was in ground either ground configuration or a procedural problem. I guess the answer to that is anytime you're locked up on S-band, you're going to have good voice comm. It just sounds like a telephone. And when you're dropping in and out of acquisition, it gets a little noisy. And, of course, the VHF is not quite as clear if you're having to operate on it at one of these VHF-only sites. I don't know. Comm is one of those things that, you know, one day it's good and one day it's bad, and I can't really explain why. And a good example is you felt it was better today. And
I know there's been some anxiety up till now why it had not been nearly as good as on previous missions, and it struck me as just being a bit clear.
Well, let me tell you the prime reason that the comm is not as good on an Earth orbital mission. You have this acquisition, reacquisition problem in an Earth orbit mission where you have to continually reacquire and get the system locked on at the ground station, and we're talking about stations that have passes that probably average 5 to 7 minutes. They really just don't have the time. By the time we get locked up solid, we generally get 2 or 3, 4 good minutes of data, and then we can lose some. Now, on the lunar mission, of course, when you got that long look time at them, you have time to really get it locked up and keep it solid. It's just primarily a problem of Earth orbital missions, I think.
Okay, Rhett, go ahead, and I.
Did you ever get squared away on who threw what comm mode switches on that long period when you couldn't call them up, Stu, during the EVA? Did you get an explanation of that by the time you left?
No, we're still arguing over that one, I guess. I don't understand it. I don't think the VHF uplink was getting to him. I'm convinced it wasn't, because in that EVA mode, the VHF up is turned around by the command module relay and sent down again. So you get this echoing. You hear yourself talking. When we didn't have comm, I wasn't getting that. And now, whether the PLIS was, they were doing a lot of talking. Whether or not they were muting out the receivers on both spacecraft by their talking, and in that EVA you've got a Vox-operated comm mode there, and whether one of the Vox sensors was constantly keying and knocking out the VHF, or whether or not we weren't getting out of the site, this is being looked at. But no, I haven't heard a good explanation for it. It seemed like we had them at the start, we had them at the end, and a long period of time in between with their comm coming through beautifully, as you heard. It was fantastic.
Okay, thank you very much.